From the 9th to the 11th of April, Charleston Festival Edit presents three digital events with leading thinkers, writers, and artists, interdisciplinary conversations, readings, and performances that are the hallmark of the Charleston Festival. Exploring art, economics, film, literature, music, and society, the Charleston Festival Edit will give audiences a digital bite-sized snapshot of what the 10-day Charleston Festival normally looks like, and which is usually held annually at Charleston in East Sussex in May. I am joined today by Susanna Stevenson, the Artistic Director at Charleston Festival, to tell us more about the Charleston Edit. Welcome, Susanna.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming in to our virtual studio. Susanna, can you talk about the history of Charleston for anyone that might not have heard about it?
Sure, so this is actually the 32nd year of the Charleston Festival. It was started in 1989 by Diana Reich, who was artistic director for 30 years and grew it from 30 people sitting in what was for a long time the cafe at Charleston, looking at the impact of the fall of the Berlin Wall, all the way through to an event which will, well, a festival that spans 10 days with 40 events and usually around 100 or so participants and speakers and performers as part of it, with 10,000 people coming to it. So essentially, I am following on in Diana's huge shoes, having joined Charleston at the end of 2019. And it's all about the interdisciplinarity of the Bloomsbury Group that spent so much time at Charleston. About what I love about the Charleston Festival is that there are so many disciplines and so many histories and so many stories that you can tap into by relating it to that history and to those people. So in your wonderful introduction about the Charleston Festival Edit, you know, we're even within the small program that we're presenting now, trying to reflect that range of interests and the benefit of looking at things across disciplines. So economics, art, music, literature, history, society, all of these things were being interrogated by the people who lived at Charleston at the time. And essentially with the Charleston Festival every year, we are just bringing that spirit back to life and having those conversations and experiences all over again.
So you mentioned, Susanna, the people that lived in Charleston at the time. Who were they and what did they do there?
Sure. So Charleston was the home of Vanessa Bell and Duncan Grant, who were but two amazing 20th century artists working in the modernist field. So they moved to Charleston in 1916. During World War One, and it was related to the fact that Duncan Grant and his friend Bunny conscientious objectors, and were going out to Sussex to actually work on the land, and took this house on as a beautiful farmhouse. And what they did is they created a living, breathing artist's home. They painted every surface, all the furniture, with installed ceramics. And it's an amazing place to go. And it will be open again soon on the 19th of May, because it sort of, they lived and breathed what they made. So they're known for their artworks and also for their Omega workshops, producing furniture and materials and things as well. But the house is a real testament to their creativity and their sort of desire just to experiment and do it and see how it plays out, and being willing to break down those boundaries of, you know, should I really paint that wall with a mural? I'm just going to give it a go and see what happens. So the house was lived in by Duncan Grant all the way through until his death. And then the Charleston Trust was formed, and it's now a house, yes, but also the garden, which was a really important part of the house for them. They used it a lot to paint from, and also just to be sociable in, because it was a real social hub for, you know, artists and thinkers and writers at the time. But we're now also doing art exhibitions. We've got a cafe, and of course we have the Charleston Festival, as well as talks and performances and workshops with activists and artists and writers and thinkers. So we've hosted the likes of David Attenborough and Ai Weiwei, Patti Smith, Salman Rushdie, Ali Smith. It's a beautiful place, but it's also so much more than its beauty because of the bite of the history that's there behind it as well.
So unfortunately, you have not managed yet as director to put on an in-person event, which must be highly...
No.
Can we talk about the impact that COVID has had on Charleston and your experience in bringing the festival online?
Sure. I mean, COVID has been a challenge for everyone, for the whole of society, for arts organisations not being able to welcome visitors or, you know, audiences is terrible, because that is at the heart of what we do. It's at the heart of all, you know, festivals and performances and gigs. So there's no denying that it's been a challenge, and to have to close the site for the sake of everyone's safety comes with a lot of financial challenges, as well as the emotional ones of having, especially the first year with the festival was done, and then we had to unpick the whole thing. At the same time, what I've really enjoyed seeing is how innovative and, I suppose, bloody-minded and determined a lot of artists and event organisers have been in taking the work online, in presenting it in new ways, in thinking about new ways to talk to audiences. And that is, I suppose, a silver lining to this whole experience. So in May last year, we took 10 events from the programme of 40 events that would have taken place physically and transposed them into online events. And I actually remember, it almost feels nostalgic now. At the time, I wrote up these really detailed notes to speakers on this thing called Zoom and how they downloaded it and how we were going to use it, which now feels incredibly retro when I discovered that document the other day. But what it meant is that we were able to just put the festival out there, and also in a really good way, have it be exposed to a whole range of audiences that might never have made the journey to Charleston itself. So one real upside of all of this, and I'm an incorrigible positive thinker, is that I'm hopeful that come the end of this period, we have broadened our audiences, because by being forced to be nimble and transpose and try and, you know, salvage the work that had been done in this other form, we've been able to watch people tuning into events from, you know, Texas, from Singapore, in addition to people all over the UK and the loyal audience who've been coming to the physical festival for years. And what I'm hoping is that, having made that discovery, we can then take them with us and keep building on that and keep doing things, and that is the positive side. We've also discovered that in working in this way, you're able to have conversations with people who would never have traveled. So for example, with the Charleston Festival edit, we're talking to James Ivory, who I don't know if he would have flown all the way over the Atlantic to speak at the Charleston Festival itself. But now we can just have a conversation with him about something incredibly relevant at a great time. And that's entirely possible through these, you know, digital rooms that we now meet in. Those conversations can happen and people can watch them from wherever they are.
Absolutely. So as well as James, who else have you got on the Charleston Edit lineup?
Sure. So James Ivory is in conversation with Samira Ahmed, and Samira is interviewing him about his life and his work, and especially the place that E.M. Forster holds within that. So James Ivory, I mean, A Room with a View is possibly still his most well-known film. And following on from the success of that, he continued to delve into Forster's work and eventually lit upon Maurice, actually is the last novel that he had read out of Forster's, you know, repertoire. And lots of people will have seen the you know, the 80s film adaptation with Hugh Grant of Maurice, which is what James Ivory made as part of the Merchant Ivory Productions. Amazing series of films. And it's a fantastic story of someone finding a way to express themselves and being who they are. But there's also so much around repression and Edwardian society and the things which inhibit people from expressing their real selves, which James Ivory, there's an interview with him from closer to the film's publication, which talks about him saying, oh, well, it's still relevant now. And what I love is that we can come back to it 50 years after the publication of Maurice and go, it's still relevant now. Those are conversations that are, you know, still happening. And what I love is that James Ivory has told me that he tried to meet up with E.M. Forster in the 60s. So they were going back and forth with letters and telegrams, and they'd arranged this meeting, and then it suddenly fell through at the last minute. And then sadly, Forster died, and they never managed to have this meeting with the two of them together. But of course, Forster's work carried on having a huge impact on James Ivory's filmmaking. So that is that's a highlight. The second event, I'm not doing these in order now. The second event I'm going to mention is Doing the Numbers, A Feminist Economics. So this is Eugenia Cheng and Linda Scott in conversation with Anita Anand. And they're two actually quite different thinkers. So Eugenia Cheng is a mathematician. She's not, you know, she's not an economist. She's not a feminist writer as such. She works in abstract mathematics and specifically an area called category theory. But she's written this great book called X Plus Y, A Mathematician's Manifesto for Rethinking Gender. And what she does is she kind of takes these tools of abstract mathematics where you boil things down to categories and the relationships to ultimately go, being female doesn't really matter here, and therefore how can we explode this whole conversation we've been having to everyone's benefit? Because what we're looking at is behaviors, and actually if we can all behave slightly differently, then it's not about leaning in, it's about changing the nature of our society in a much more generous and inclusive way to everyone's benefit. And Linda Scott does something really, really similar in The Double X Economy, her book. I mean, Linda Scott is an incredible economist. She's been listed in Prospect Magazine's top global 25 thinkers. And she really knows her stuff. And at the same time is making a similar argument. If you empower women economically, everyone benefits. For example, giving female entrepreneurs in Britain equal access to capital would add 250 billion to the economy. And if the gender pay gap were closed, the global economy's wealth would be $160 trillion higher. So they're both, you know, coming at it from really different perspectives. One, you know, economics on the ground, case studies, doing the work, advising global thinkers, and the other, abstract mathematics, to both come to the same conclusion about how can we rethink this whole business to the benefit of everyone. So I would definitely recommend tuning in for that one. Some of the things I heard them say, because I've seen it, I've seen the conversation, I've had a sneak preview, are fascinating. And the third event is, I mean, it's really a Charleston suite of events because it's performative. It's got music and word in an incredible visual art setting. So the third event is called The Waves 90th Anniversary Performance. And what we've done is taken the words of Virginia Woolf's most experimental novel, The Waves, in its 90th anniversary year, and formed a script which weaves together words from this novel, all about six close friends whose lives all interweave in the same way that the words do. And put those together with extracts from Virginia Woolf's diaries where she's reflecting on writing the novel and the music that she's listening to while she's writing it, and have married that with a musical score, which is being played by the Brighton Philharmonic Orchestra, a string quartet taken from the orchestra, and the brilliant pianist, Joanna McGregor. And what we're able to make then is, it lasts around 45 minutes, but it's a full, you know, a full start to finish performance of this, the words of Virginia Woolf, read by Harriet Walter and Vera Chock, interweaving with a score of music with Beethoven, Bach and Schubert, as well as a brand new piece written by Joanna, especially to capture the spirit of the waves, which shows the musical, in what she was taking her inspiration from musically. You hear that, you know, how the instruments are weaving together, and then you can map that onto the way that she makes the voices weave together in the text. And then, and this is another example of a silver lining of the situation that we're all in, is we were able to film it all in the beautiful Berwick Church, which anyone who's, when everyone next comes to Charleston, take a detour and go to nearby Berwick, because it is beautiful, this church, because it's lined with murals done by Duncan Grant, Vanessa Bell and her son Quentin Bell, and they've all just, the whole church has recently undergone an extensive renovation, and it looks beautiful, but also the paintings are relevant to all of the themes that you find in the waves around personal relationships and grief and sort of life that continues, that carries on, the thrust of humanity that you find on the walls of this church. And so, no, we couldn't do it in front of a big live audience, which was the initial plan when I was conceiving it last autumn. But instead, we've got a really special script and performance, which is talking. It's a conversation between the paintings and the musicians and the readers, all bringing this thing to life. So that's the Charleston Festival edit. There's one event each night over the 9th to the 11th of April. And then they're actually online on demand until the 16th of May. So you don't need to worry if you're not available at 7 p.m. on the night where it's initially premiering, because you can always come back and rewatch them all the way through until the 16th of May.
Thank you very much for joining us, Susanna. And we are going to play you out with a clip from that performance this afternoon. So take care and really good luck with the festival.
Thank you, Anna. Take care.
Now let us say brutally and directly what is in our minds, said Neville. Our isolation, our preparation is over.
Old Mrs. Constable lifted her sponge and warmth poured over us, said Bernard. We became clothed in this changing, this feeling garment of flesh.
The boot boy made love to the scullery maid in the kitchen garden, said Susan, among the blown out washing.
The tiger leapt, and the swallow dipped her wings in dark pools on the other side of the world, said Rhoda.
But here and now we are together, said Bernard. We have come together at a particular time to this particular spot. We are drawn into this communion by some deep, some common emotion. Shall we call it conveniently love?